Here, Bill, is your accomplishment. And here, Bill, is your fame. Glorious in its anonymity. And bright in its humility. And here, Bill, are some of your candles, just a few, returned to greet you on this, your 20th anniversary.
This meeting fittingly opened with a great and wonderful silence. And what we collectively felt and thought in that silence is surely quite beyond any expression at all. I'm sure as seldom before, we all felt the presence of God. I am sure that every heart here looked up to Him in thanksgiving for His gifts to us, the children of the night. We thanked Him for freedom from bondage. We thanked Him for our deliverance into a fellowship where we have learned that it is better to comfort than to be comforted. It is better to love than to be loved. We thanked Him for the opportunity to serve man and God, such as has seldom been accorded anyone. Then, too, there has been a very personal note sounded here. I'm Lois and I know that you're coming from so many distant places. It's a mighty token of your affection for us. She and I give our thanks to you and to God for all of that. It is her anniversary, quite as much as mine, because I had reached the place where I would die, and she had reached the place where all of her bright hopes and aspirations were at an end. And then through this strange paradox, strength rising from weakness, a door was opened upon a new way of life, quite beyond our wildest dreams in even the balmiest of our days. Such are my poor words to express what I have felt here. These gifts are as three stars which commenced to run even prior to the year 34. The gifts and the stories which tell about them are these. One is the story of how we learn to break our bondage. The next is the story of how we learned to live in harmony and unity with each other and with the world about us. And the third legacy of AA has to do with how we learn to serve God and man. I wish it were possible for me to give you a rundown on all these stories. But when I proposed this to the dinner committee, they said, "Bill, tell us that night before Christmas yarn. You know, just how did this thing really get started?" But before I embark on that, I draw attention to the fact that practically every alcoholic in this room has had someone, some friend, who stuck with him, who stayed with him, who went into the cave where he was and never left. So I would introduce to you my partner in the cave, and my partner since, without whom this society would in all probability never have been. And Lois would like to say to you her thanks on her anniversary.
This is really, I think, one of the most moving moments of my life. And I can't say anything, I can't half express what it means to me and what being here and seeing so many of you and feeling all your love. I hope you feel mine going out to you. But I do want to thank you, every last one of you, for all you have done through these 20 years. Because this 20 years is not only accomplishment of the first early AAs, but of every single one of you. Because if you all hadn't wanted to carry this wonderful thing on, each one forging a link in this marvelous chain that is AA, we none of us, I'm sure, would be here tonight. And thank you again so very much.
Over the AA grapevine, just before dinner, there came a flash, and the flash came out of Knickerbocker Hospital. And the flash said, the 10,000th drunk number 10,000, has just passed through this place, and his name is Murphy. Therefore, I can say without fear of contradiction that Mr. Murphy is the augury of greater things to come in the destiny of this society. And after hearing that word and sitting here and looking into your faces and realizing that all of us gathered here plus all those who recovered of the 10,000 who went through Knickerbocker, no doubt 6 or 7. But that was 6 or 7,000, I would say. That doubtless is perhaps 4 or 5% of all that has happened in the way of recovery. There are lots of our friends here tonight. And there are lots of AAs here tonight who really don't know much about the actual start of AA. It can't be said often enough that no human being invented Alcoholics Anonymous. God in His providence channeled ideas and inspiration through many, many individuals to bring this society to the point where it stands today. Friends, non-alcoholics, have been used tremendously and repeatedly in the formation of our recovery program, of contributions which have borne on our wholeness and unity, and they have, in legions, helped us to serve and carry this message worldwide. Tonight, I would just like to talk about the recovery. And I would like to talk about 4 people who, in my estimate, were indispensable channels through which the main ideas coursed into us alcoholics. Again, we alcoholics invented nothing. The story properly begins at Zurich, Switzerland, probably in the year 1930. And a certain American businessman had gone there that we shall call Rowe. A man of affairs, a man of prominence, a man of parts. Well, he's probably what nowadays we call Park Avenue stonkin' bum. He had run the usual course we know so well, trying out places, sanitarium. So he said, I will seek out the best man on earth. I'll go to Carl Jung. He went there. He stayed a year. He meant business. And at the end of the year, he thought he so well understood himself that he had been really released from his obsession to drink. To his consternation, he was drunk in a matter of weeks. And trembling, crawled back to Dr. Jung. And that very great and humble man said to him, Roland, when you first came, I thought you might be one of those rare ones. But I must be frank to tell you that I have never seen one single alcoholic of your kind and gravity recover under my care. I can do nothing for you. I think that is a humility which a good many an alcoholic could borrow when talking about psychiatry. Well, our friend from America was shattered. The God of science had spoken the word of doom. So he went back to the doctor like this. He said, but doctor, is there nothing? Well, said Dr. Carl Jung, sometimes alcoholics have religious experiences, conversions if you like, Which liberate?
It happens here and there. It happens now and then. We can't quite say why and how.
Ovid said Rome, I'm a man of faith.
Used to be a vestryman in the Episcopal Church. Doctor shook his head. Said, that's fine. But not fine enough. I'm talking about the kind of transforming experience that remotivates and transforms people. Where can I find an experience like that, said Rome. Well, the doctor said you'll have to seek it in any religious channel of your own choice. If you seek, perhaps you will find. No one can say. So Roland started his quest, and he met up with the Oxford groups of that time, and they were a band of people who were talking a very simple and direct way of life. They were talking about absolute honesty, absolute purity, absolute unselfishness, absolute love. They were talking about the guidance of God. They weren't talking much theology. They were just talking common denominators of all of us. And in this atmosphere, putting all he had into the situation, Roland experienced this mysterious and unaccountable departure of his obsession and dread. He returned to America, went to his farm at Glastonbury, Vermont, where he was joined by two other alcoholics, one by the name of Shep, another by the name of Seaver. And one of these fellows knew the chap that we in AA affectionately call Eppy, my schoolmate up there in Vermont. Eppy was up in the old hometown, they heard, and he was raising particular hell. The family had gone back to Albany. They just summered there at Manchester. Ebby had got a hold of Pop's new car. He had run it off the road into the side of a farmhouse. The car made a clean, neat entry into the kitchen, pushing the stove aside, but none of the occupants. Whereupon Ebby had stepped out and said, folks, how about a cup of coffee? Well, the neighbors up there who loved the boy figured that they had about enough, so they would send him down to Bennington and before Judge Graves, Seabra's father, and get him committed to Brattleboro. The trio at Glastonbury heard about this. They went and fetched it. And here was the transmission line again at work. I saw Abby only recently in Texas. And he recalled the terrific impression that Roland had made on him. The God of Science in Zurich had said, you cannot do anything about this alone. You have to have some kind of transforming experience. And Abby again recounted to me only months ago how deeply that hit when another alcoholic gave him the note. Meanwhile, I had been approaching Abby's step. The end of the long road for Lois and me came up here in Towns Hospital in the summer of 1934. Like Rowland's case,
The doctor there, one we all now know as Silky, thought that I might be one of those rare ones that could recover. But here he was in his office on a hot night talking to Lois while I lay upstairs. Here came the same sentence again. Lois is saying to him, but doctor, he's a man of tremendous willpower. He wants to stop. Why can't he stop? Then the dear old man was obliged to pass sentence. He was kind, but there wasn't anything. Said he, Bill's habit of drink has now turned into an obsession which his will can't break. There is nothing that I can do to educate him out of this. There is nothing that any physical treatment can do that I know anything about. I am at the end of my resources. So, Lois, like Roland said, well, doctor, what next? And Silky said, I'm afraid you'll have to lock him up. Else he'll go mad and die some of these days. Well, I left town. By this time I knew what the score was. For a while fear kept me sober. Terrific vigilance, fighting this thing all the time. Some months went by, something very unusual for me. Oh, I was a 2-bottle man a day, 3 to get drunk. So 2 or 3 months of sobriety. Then I began to get self-confidence. I began to say to myself, well, this isn't too bad. I'm beginning to feel better. I go over to Wall Street, I make a few dollars. Maybe this isn't so bad. Then 20 years ago, come day after tomorrow, Armistice Day, 1934, I said to Lois as she set out to work in the department store, where all our support now came from, I said, Lois, I'd like to go over to Staten Island and play a round of golf. I could see the fear in her eyes. She said, oh, dude, you haven't done that in a long time. Soon I'm going down the aisle. Beside me is a man with a fine target rifle. We get talking about shooting. All of a sudden, the bus collides with the bus ahead of us. Nobody is hurt, but we're left standing on the pavement waiting for the next bus. Said the man to me, let's go in there. I think maybe we can get a drink. I said, let's do. So we went inside. And I ordered ginger ale. What? He said, don't you drink? No, I said, I am an alcoholic. I am a guy who has an obsession that I've just got to break. This obsession drives me to drink. According to the doctors, I've got a physical sensitivity that condemns me to go mad or die if I keep it up. That's how bad I am. That's why I'm drinking ginger ale. Okay, the fellow said, please go right on. If you don't mind, though, I'll have a scotch and soda. Another. We get on the bus, and this so well demonstrates this insidious insanity. We come to the parting of the ways. I'm going to the golf course. He's going to the rifle range. We're in front of another little hotel. The bus is stopped. It's noontime. Says he, let's go in. We'll get a sandwich. We sat at the bar. He had another drink, a sandwich. I get a sandwich, a glass of ginger ale. We sit there still talking about shooting. And I remembered then how I began to sort of wool gather. The place in back of us was filling up with celebrants of Armistice Day. And the people, they were filling up too, and that buzz arose that we know so well in the bar room. And somehow that was reminiscent of that marvelous Armistice Day in France. Oh, what a wonderful release that was. The champagne we had in Bordeaux. And these thoughts ran as an undercurrent in my mind. Along comes the bridegroom. Bright as a button. A glass in each hand. He plumps one down in front of my friend. He plumps another down in front of me. And he says, "Boys, it's Armistice Day. Have one on the house." I said, "Thanks very much," and go. My friend looked at me and said he, "Are you completely crazy? Do you realize what you told me up the street only an hour ago?" "Oh, yes," I said, "I guess I am crazy. And I won." Lois found me lying in the area way of 182 Clinton Street where we lived the next morning, still dragging the golf bag, terrific gash in my scalp where I'd fallen against the steel grate. Well, then I was back on it. What was the use? A week later, the telephone rings. My friend Evie, who is on this line of succession from Dr. Jung to Roland, is now on the other end of the wire. Oh, I thought to myself, this is one. We'll talk about the good old days. Why would we talk about the good old days? Because the present was practically unbearable and there wasn't to be any future. Yes, we drink up my gin and we talk about the good old days. Soon, Evie is in the door. Through my haze, I could somehow sense that he was different. Something had happened. He came in. I pushed the gin over the table. No. Not drinking. Not drinking now. What, are you on the water wagon? No. Not exactly. I'm just not drinking now. What's got into you? Abby? Well, he said, "I got religion." Well, that was a terrific jolt to me. Then I knew for sure he was crazy. You see, I'd had one of these dandy modern educations that had taught me that man is God. Well, you had to be polite. I said, "What brand?" "Oh, well," he said, "I don't know if you'd call it a religion." I ran across a crowd of people, and then he recounted this experience I've just told you. And then he began to tell of his contact with this crowd of people, most of them non-alcoholics, but here and there, there were some alcoholics. But really, this man had role. And he began to tell me that though he didn't agree with all of their tenets and some of their methods, of course, alcoholics are great people who disagree, but he had abstracted from what they taught certain basics that had released him, he said, from his desire to drink. And what were these basics? Well, there was the idea of a personal inventory of one's defects. There was the idea of confessing these in confidence to another person. There was the idea of making restitution for harms done. There was the idea of carrying that message to other people. There was the idea of dependence upon and guidance upon God as you understood. Those were the essential ideas that he transmitted to me over the kitchen table. Well, I said, Abby, this sounds perfectly sensible, all except the God bit. After all, these aren't any very new ideas either. You might have got these most any place. Well, he said, but the point is, I got them, and this is where I got them.
Oh, is that a bunch of Oxford Group things? And I think that Rollin made me ready to receive those ideas. If I hadn't been first approached by alcoholics, I don't believe those people could have sold me this bill of goods. But he said, I have bought enough of it so that I feel released. It seems to me that I'm not any longer fighting booze. The obsession has been lifted out. Release, he talked about. And then he went away. Didn't press me, didn't evangelize me, didn't try to save my soul. I went on drinking for a while. And in no waking hour could I get the spectacle of that fellow sitting across that kitchen table out of my mind. So here you were, one alcoholic talking to another. Young had said it's hopeless. Hazard had got transformed. He passed it along to Abby. Abby had been exposed to these people who were practicing what they preached. And he, another alcoholic, was talking to me across the kitchen table. And then in my background was another god of science who said, no, science can't do it for me. So, I was being made ready through all these agencies and people for what was about to happen. Abby came another time with his friend Shep. I remember going down to Old Calvary Mission, getting there terribly drunk. They were about to throw me out. I said I was looking for something. Abby said, how about a plate of beans? They get me sober enough. They take me in. I sit with the other penitents. I take the walk up the aisle. And as I knelt there among those sweaty people, I remember getting a little feeling of something new and different. And then it was gone again, and I went back to drinking, and I went back to fighting this God idea. But always the face of this drunk across that kitchen table. And I knew that he wasn't on the water wagon. Something had removed his obsession to drink. So I said, well, if there's any great doctor, I'd better seek him out. But first of all, I better get sober. I go back to town's hospital. Oh, I want the head of the DTs this time. Not in too bad shape. Determined to get sober and have another look at this neat little formula. I arrived there, bottle in hand. I remember Silky standing in the hall, shaking his head. I yelled at him, waving a bottle, saying, this time I got something, Doc. He said, I'm afraid you have, boy, upstairs today. The poor old man really loved me as he loved all of those 10,000 drunks that have gone through Knickerbocker and the other 30,000 he talked with besides. So I go to bed. 3 days later, my friend shows up in the door. I said, uh-oh, maybe he's going to evangelize me. Maybe he's going to put heat on me. Maybe he's going to try to save my soul. Didn't do any such thing. He was full of that great Christian virtue called prudence. He knew my prejudices. He waited and made me ask, Abby, what's that neat little formula? Oh, yeah, you get honest with yourself. You get honest with another person about yourself. Internal house cleaning. Clean away the debris of the past. Help others with no demand for reward and prestige or money. Pray to God as you understand Him for guidance to direct your life and expel His obsession. As simple as that. Nothing more, nothing less. And soon he was gone. And still I rebel. And suddenly, I suppose, and momentarily certainly, this terrific ego of mine just collapsed. And I dropped into a terrific depression. And in the agony of that depression, I cried out. I said, now, I am prepared to do anything, anything, anything at all to get whatever it is. Like a cancer patient, if there's any great physician. If there is any God, let him show himself. And then the place went electric in a great white light. I was seized with an ecstasy, which is in nobody's power to describe. In the mind's eye, it seemed as though I was on a mountain, a great wind is blowing. I think this is not air, this is of spirit. I'm free. Then the ecstasy subsides, and I find that I'm in another world. A world in which everything is all right, no matter how wrong it seems to be. The assurance was complete. There was a sensation that I was surrounded by and suffused with a presence. And I thought to myself, so this is the God of the preachers. Such was the gift that I received that day. And such were the sources through which it had come. Well, pretty soon another source comes walking into that hospital in the shape of a book. It was called Varieties of Religious Experience by William James. I think it was then in circulation among the Oxford group. And I remember how avidly I went through those pages, kind of a learned document, a little over my head. But out of it stood these common denominators. The people who get these transforming experiences the more readily are those who utterly surrender and give up. Then the transformation sets in. Oh, sometimes in a blaze such as mine did. That doesn't make any difference. May take weeks, may take months, but it is a transforming experience that apparently arises out of some terrific collapse at depth. That much stood out of those pages. And then I realized how I had been conditioned for this. The God of science, Dr. Jung, Dr. Silkworth, said, no. You can't do it on your own resource. You can't do it on the resources of science. Of yourself, you are literally nothing. It isn't a question of God's help, and you'll do it. You can't do anything. And when we got to that point of complete defeat, when those cases in the book did, then the transformation would set in and would so change and remotivate the people affected that it couldn't be accounted for by any association or program of discipline or what have you. It began to be clear what was happening. So I go down to the Oxford groups. Now when I arrived down there in the Oxford groups, I think I caused Sam and his dear friends almost as much trouble as the guys with the alarm clock. Because I had this very fixed idea. Maybe it was partly inspiration, but I fancy there was a good deal of conceit in it. I was soon heard to say, I am going to sober up all the drunks in the world. And we set out a pace to do it. The house over Clinton Street was filled with drunks. We visited them at Calvary, Mission, up at Towns Hospital, anywhere we could lay hands on them, and nothing whatever happened for 6 months. Brief period of sobriety, and then bang. Meanwhile, I was telling people about this strange experience. I was preaching. I was teaching. I was playing the Messiah. And nobody would buy it. So one day, pretty crestfallen, I went up to confide in good old Doc Silkworth. He said, look, Bill, you got the cart before the horse. What about this James book? You used to talk about this idea of getting this deflation at depth. He said, you're running around talking about this mystic experience of yours and people think they're nuts. No, he said, you've got the cart before the horse. You can identify with these people. You've had a drinking experience. You can do it where I can't do it. But then why don't you pour it into them? How utterly hopeless from a medical standpoint this thing is. The obsession that condemns them to drink against their will and their best interest, and the increasing bodily sensitivity that ensures they'll go mad or die. Pour that into them, and maybe that'll soften them up. And then they'll buy some of this morality. And some of these ideas that will cure them. About that time, people began to murmur, why doesn't this guy go to work? In fact, I think some of my friends got guidance from God that I should go back to work. It was eminently practical guidance. So I began to sit around Wall Street brokerage houses like Micawber, waiting for something to turn up. And it did. And suddenly I'm in the midst of a little proxy row that took me out to Akron, Ohio, and there's a great milling around, and through some quickly found friends, I hope to get control, listen to the word, of a small company. And then, of course, that would supply me the living in my spare time. Maybe we'd fix some drunks. We get to Akron. The deal blows up in my face. My friends depart in disgust. I'm in the Mayflower Hotel with $10 in my pocket, not enough for a fare home. For the first time since that experience in Towns Hospital, I began to be afraid. I found myself walking up and down in the Mayflower lobby. It was Saturday afternoon. The bar room was filling up. Then I eased down to the other end of the corridor, and there stood a church director. And absolutely, I kept looking at it. Then suddenly, I was seized with a real panic. I said to myself, look, my friend, you're in a fair way to get drunk. Then I'd walk up and down again. Well, why not go in the bar room and order a bottle of ginger ale? You might scrape an acquaintance. Pretty lonely there. And then it occurred to me. It was born in upon me for the first time. That even though the effort I had made with other alcoholics had apparently brought nothing to them, it had brought a great deal to me. Then I say, oh, not teacher, not preacher, not evangelist. No, I need another alcoholic so that I can forget my troubles by talking to him. I need him as much as he needs me. And I stopped again before the church directory, ran my finger down a list of churches and preachers. It stopped at the name of Walter Thomas. Turned out to be the Episcopal preacher in town. I called up and I said, I'm an alcoholic from New York. I'm in a bad way. I'm not drunk, but I may get that way. I gotta have another drunk to work on. Well, this was something of a shock to the good man. Drunks, one by one, were bad enough, but not by twos and threes. However, he caught on. He was very nice. He gave me a list of some Oxford Group people. Well, the Oxford Group at that stage in Akron had kind of broken up into some factions. Nevertheless, one chap was very helpful. I finally got a list of maybe 10 people. I began to call them up. Well, as I say, it was a Saturday afternoon. People were going away. They couldn't be found. See you in church Sunday. Until I finally exhausted the whole list. At the end of the list stood the name of Cyberly. And I said, uh-oh. Must be the wife of that rubber magnate. What would she want with a drunk from New York on a Saturday afternoon looking for a drunk to work on? I even went downstairs and looked in the bar again, and something said to me, you'd better go up there and make that call. So I did. A lovely southern voice came over the wire. I quickly told her my story. She said, I'm no alcoholic, but I think I understand. Will you come right straight out here? Another friend who had time and who cared enough. I told her the story. She told me about Dr. Bob. How he'd fallen apart in that town as a surgeon. How he'd tried the groups. How he'd read religious literature. How he'd tried church attendance. How he'd been treated medically. She knew he wanted to stop. Why couldn't he stop? She called us. Anne answered. And Anne said, well, this sounds interesting, Henrietta, but I don't think we can come over today. You see, it's Mother's Day, and Bob is a sentimental man, and he has just come home with a great big potted plant for me, and he has set the plant upon the table, but he is so potted he is on the floor. So I don't think we can get over today. Well, said Henrietta Brightly, won't you come over tomorrow? So next afternoon, at 5 o'clock, Dr. Bob and Ann walked in the door of Henrietta's house. She discreetly ushered Dr. Bob and me into her library. Dr. Bob said, I can't stay but a few minutes. I said, I know just how you feel. You're shaky. You probably want a drink. The upshot was that we talked for 4 or 5 hours. And as his story in the book Alcoholics Anonymous will show, and as his recording made at Detroit not long before he died further demonstrates, the impression I made upon him was not directly of any character at all. He says over and over, this is the first man that I ever met up with who knew what he was talking about concerning alcoholism out of his own experience and out of the mouths of science. In other words, I took Sophie's advice and I poured the death sentence into him as hard as I could, so far as his being able to get over it by himself. The spark that was to be Alcoholics Anonymous was probably struck then and there. I went to live with Dr. Bob and thought it would be a little safer. My business continued somehow in Akron for a while. I stayed there during that summer. And pretty soon Dr. Bob was saying to me, Bill, we better get to work. We better find some drugs. So he called the city hospital. Got a hold of the head nurse down there. Said there was a man from New York with a cure for alcoholism. The nurse said, Doctor, have you tried it yourself? He persisted. She said, we've got just a man for it. Jeff came in here, used to be a city councilman, well-known lawyer about town. Couldn't get home from here the last 6 times. Been in there 6 times in 4 months. Couldn't even get home, so. We've got him strapped down. He blacked the eyes of one nurse before we did it. How would that one suit you? We've got some rough, put him to bed. Here's the medication. We'll be down as soon as he cleared up. And presently, Dr. Bob and I looked at the first man on the bed. And that was who passed out of our sighting hearing only a few weeks ago, who never relapsed since.
He kept the faith. Then in Akron, the city on the hill, three candles were lit, and it stayed lit. How many people then contributed? Vital contributions. Dr. Jung, good old Silky, William James, Sam Schumacher. Who then invented Alcoholics Anonymous? Well, it was God Almighty. Such is the story of how we alcoholics learn to be free of our obsession. May God grant that this AA Trinity of recovery, of unity, and of service be a story which shall continue so long into the future as God may need us.